This is an ABC podcast.
Okay, Steph, politics quiz. How many children did the first woman to be elected to the House of Representatives, Enid Lyons, have?
Too many. 11.
11! Yeah, she did. How much does that freak you out?
It freaks me out a lot.
You'd be very tired. They were just the surviving ones. She gave birth to more.
Really?
But there were 11 surviving children when
That's
she...
That's too much to be in Parliament.
I know.
You're having 11 kids at home.
To be honest, she probably went to Parliament for a bit of a rest. But ever since Enid, mother of many, arrived in the Parliament, female politicians have faced heaps of questions about kids. Do they want them? Will they have them? Are they doing a good enough job of looking after them? Lots of questions. So today we're going to talk about being a real woman.
Real woman.
A real woman. Do you think you can be a real woman without having children?
I don't know.
Because, I'm asking this because, like, this question of motherhood has been like a real, like, such a really weird...
hot button issue.
For women in politics for a long time. And
yeah,
here's why. Like, back in the suffragist days when women were first trying to get the vote, one of the, like, big arguments about women having the vote or being involved in politics was that children would be neglected.
Yeah.
You know, that women's job is to look after the home. Mm-hmm. And if women started getting, you know, involved in stuff like politics, that these children would go unfed, the, you know, marriages would be destroyed, the family would be decimated. And, like, you know, in this country, this stuff is still really recent. Like, up until 1966, it was the law of the federal Commonwealth that female public servants, if they got married, had to quit their jobs.
Oh, my God, that's so
right?
Recent.
1966 is when we got rid of that. Like, it's so recent. Like, my mother-in-law was subject to this treatment. Like, because, and the idea was that, well, if you were going to have a family, then you shouldn't have a job too.
This is a really interesting topic because I am really clucky at the moment. But I'm also really hitting my stride in my career.
Right.
And this is like the hardest, this is a question I ask myself constantly, is I always had this dream when I was young that I wanted to have kids young. And I changed it to I want to have kids before I'm 30.
Right.
But it's getting bloody close now.
Right. So the question of like juggling the responsibilities of a family with work is like still this sort of question or equation that kind of weirdly seems to apply to women more than men, or women kind of automatically tangled with it, whereas with men...
And we're proud of men if they have a family. Like, we go, well done.
Good on you.
Yeah.
But, I mean, like, you know, men have been sort of breeding in the parliament and in the cabinet for, like, time immemorial, and no one ever cares or says, oh, I wonder, where's the baby? Who's looking after the baby?
Yeah.
But there were also some women who didn't have children, either as, like, as a choice or because it just didn't happen. But those women end up facing all these weird questions when they get to Parliament about, well, you know, do you really understand, you know,
are there
families
that you're missing out on?
Right.
Why have you chosen career? And
right.
Yeah.
And so, like, for my money, like, the moment at which this question, like, really crystallised in Australian politics was when the Liberal Senator Bill Heffernan said of Julia Gillard, who then was a senior Labor figure, not yet Prime Minister, that she was, quote, deliberately barren.
I remember being told by my media advisor that, you know, Bill Heffernan had called me deliberately barren. It was like, oh, yeah, whatever. And, you know, Bill Heffernan had a very particular political reputation as a sort of maverick that would go out and say things. And I guess there's a worthwhile political debate about how maverick was he as opposed to the person who was asked to carry some of the out there lines, and then, you know, others at the political leadership level could say afterwards, oh, that's just Bill. But one of those characters that would say quite controversial things. And I remember I was in the middle of a busy day and, you know, Bill Heffernan said this, yeah, whatever. And I think I got on a plane and was quite surprised by the time I got off that it was as huge as it was.
Do you feel like it surfaced something subterranean, that particular exchange, and allowed it to be dealt with in a way?
With the benefit of hindsight, if it hadn't been the Bill Heffernan inspired moment, I suspect there still would have been a moment in my career when not having children would have been used and I would have had to have responded. So any way you cut it, I suspect this was going to be an issue at some point. And having looked at the things that have happened to other women, what's particularly in my mind is when I spoke to Theresa May about her experiences in politics. She doesn't have children. It's well known that she and her husband would very much liked to have had children, but it simply wasn't possible for them. Mm-hmm. And so she says generally that the British media have been quite respectful about that. And given the tabloid culture in the British media, that's a pretty big thing to say.
It's it's so recent too. You look back and you think, oh my God, we'd kind of have to put women through these hoops and make them answer questions not necessarily anybody's business.
Weird question then. And I am bad for asking this question.
Go for it.
You have children, yes.
I have 3 children, yeah.
Yeah. Did you feel pressure? Did you make a decision in your mind to hit the stage in your career before you had kids? Or was it just, it happened when it happened and it happened as it happened?
Do you know what? Like, my partner may disagree with my recollection, but so I love working, like I love my job. Mm. And my partner and I had been together for like a long time, you know. And he basically said, and I think when I thought about having children, I kind of kept thinking about all the things that I would lose or that I wouldn't be able to do. And he eventually just sort of said, listen, I really want to have kids. We're going to have to, like, are we going to do this or not? And I'm like, oh, all right then. And then, like, I absolutely never for one second regretted it. In fact, I wanted to have more kids straight away. So, but, like, I changed the way that I work too. Like, and I have a job where I could change the way that I work. And I think that my career would have been super different if I didn't have kids.
Yeah.
But I also think that the disruption of having kids and taking a bit of time out and then thinking, oh, what do I want to do when I go back to work, has actually made me do way more interesting things and also made me care a bit less about taking risks and like, oh, I'm going to do this now, even if people think it's ridiculous. I'm just going to give it a shot. So, yeah, but I think in politics, it's...
Well, everything seems like a political move, doesn't it?
That's true. And also the reality of life in politics is, you know, you kind of travel away from your home. So, like, if you want to have a family while you're serving in politics, you really need a spouse. Like, if you're a woman, you need a spouse who's going to perform for you the same role as female spouses have done for male politicians for a long time. And that's difficult because the recruitment for male spouses who are happy to take over all of the home domestic responsibilities is different from the market of female spouses for male politicians who have historically done that.
I know this isn't strictly on the topic of politics, but I think it's worth mentioning. I recently came out of a relationship which was kind of built on that principle.
Right. Yeah.
He didn't work and he didn't want to work, but I am a workaholic. I love work. Mm. You know, I love being challenged. I have to have 5 things on the go at once, otherwise I don't feel like I'm doing enough. And he was like, well, I want to be the stay-at-home dad. You know, I think that it worked for me. And he was a lot older than me and it just kind of seemed like it would work. But actually the reality of that was that I think he felt quite emasculated by the reality of it. And so, you know, in theory it was what we both wanted, but in practice it required, I think, from his end, a lot more justification of his being and of his
That's so interesting. Because I think that is one of the real complications for women in politics. It's not just complicated for them. It's not just them that's doing something that's sort of a bit outside the box. It's also if they have a male partner, that's a different, like being the male spouse of a politician is different from being the female spouse of a politician. I mean, you can ask everybody from Dennis Thatcher onwards. Like there's a certain brand of kind of like, oh, you're a handbag sort of thing that is kind of, it is, it's an affront to a male identity in a way that it's not to a female identity. And lots of blokes are actually fine with it, but it's an additional layer. And
yes, I think absolutely. It makes men very intimidated by women, I think, as well. We're in an interesting space. Sorry, you said you were really young when you got with your partner, right?
Yeah.
So he got to see your success. Was he quite successful himself?
Yeah. I mean, he's he did actually become a lawyer, unlike me. So
he's,
kind of, I get to see what life is like as a lawyer.
So it's like that's different to bringing somebody into, like, I'm single now at 28 and my career is about to hit somewhere, you know, like all of that work, you know.
I think
it's starting to pay off now, but imagine asking somebody to join the journey now, you know. And I think that times 10 is the situation for politicians. It is such a public job, and then if you had decided that was the path you're taking, that would be the hardest decision to bring a kid into that.
Oh my gosh, that is completely true. And I think, you know, there is this this ancient assumption that your average politician is a bloke with a wife at home and some kids that he doesn't see very often, that any diversion from that is just sort of like a grounds for suspicion, whether it's, you know, a woman without kids or a woman with kids. And you can express itself in the most symbolic and indirect of ways. Like, remember back when Julia Gillard got, like, there was all this discussion about a photograph that she had taken where she was in her kitchen and her kitchen was really bare and there was an empty bowl next to her. And there was this massive, like, I mean, I'll get her to tell the story. I've got a little grab of it for you. But, like, it was this sort of moment where that photograph became a really powerful symbol of her childlessness. All right, take it away, Julia.
The fruit bowl. A fruit bowl that stopped a nation. It isn't necessarily a fruit bowl in the sense that it actually looks best when you can see the design at the base of it, but this image was obviously completely overread and blown up, and I didn't think about it at the time. You know, it was just a photographer, you know, take a seat, we'll get a shot. So I just didn't think through what it would mean to be photographed in a kitchen.
Do you still have the bowl?
Yes, still have the bowl.
Do you ever put anything in it?
It may actually, today as we speak, have some fruit in it. I've conceded the case, you know, over all of these years having tried to maintain to people, it's not a fruit bowl. It's just easy to say, okay, fruit.
Look, surely, like, in the history of like, Julia Gillard's experience, that must be the weirdest one. Like, because there was this, like, why is she in such an empty kitchen and why is there no fruit in her bowl?
Oh, that just pisses me off.
What does that mean?
Oh, that's just infuriating, though.
Right.
I mean, but now I'm annoyed by the question that immediately comes to my head, which is, did she ever say whether she wanted kids?
I've been asked about this a lot, and she says, I didn't ever really, I'm the sort of person who does one thing full on, and I knew that I wanted this career in politics. I wanted to devote myself to it. She said, I have the greatest admiration of people who do both, but I didn't think that I could do that. So that's what she says, you know. But, like, it's just, it reminds me just how careful you have to be about, like, how an image can get interpreted.
No, you shouldn't, though.
Well, it's just,
you know what I mean? But like, that's a fallacy. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not the responsibility.
No.
You know, I know that that isn't what you're saying, but, like, that's what sucks, is why is it her responsibility to, it's okay, so it's like the what's reasonably foreseeable, right? Like, it's,
okay,
it's the negligence, it's law, it's,
imagine,
you know,
if you foresaw that, like, what kind of person would you have to be like, oh, I better just put a few oranges in that bowl.
Exactly.
In case a couple of complete nut bars ever look at this picture and think, is this woman suffering because of her childlessness?
It's just shocking.
There's another great story that
infuriates me more than any of the other stuff for some reason, just this idea of, you're, like, I can't think of a single, well, there is no bigger commitment, a single bigger commitment or responsibility than a child. And imagine that being questioned every day.
Yeah. Well, here's another story for you. This is Natasha Stott Despoja, who was the youngest woman ever to take a seat in the Senate. She was the Democrats' leader for a while when the Democrats were still around. And she started out in politics without children. And then when she met her husband, got married, had kids while serving in the parliament. And this story is from when she was the Democrats' leader and a single image captioned during a campaign event completely kicked off this narrative about her. Here she goes.
I was campaigning in Brisbane with my colleague, Senator Andrew Bartlett. He'd just had a baby, like newborn baby, and he'd brought Lilith to come and meet me. And it was glorious. She was exquisite, beautiful. And we had those moments that politicians can only dream about. You know, 10 minutes of just beautiful photography with me and this lovely baby, not crying, you know, politicians' babies, kissing, the whole thing. And for a couple of seconds, I turned to the camera and to Andrew and everyone said, "Oh, she's so tiny, I'd be terrified of dropping her." And I did this face of horror at the thought of dropping this baby. And of course, that's the camera, brilliant, brilliant photographer, that's what he captured. But I didn't realise this. So we all celebrated that evening because it was just, it was a lovely day. And I woke up the next day to this photograph of me looking horrified at this beautiful baby. Brilliant photograph. I think it was reprinted 9 times during the election campaign in The Australian. And it became emblematic. So one columnist said that this was absolutely typical of me and my generation. Natasha hates children.
Ugh, that is infuriating.
And then she appeared at the press club later in that campaign and somebody actually asked her, "What have you got against children?" Yeah. But then, see, this is where things get interesting because then she had children. Like she had a baby while she was serving as a senator. And she says that the second she had a baby, the criticism swung around to, like, why are you neglecting that baby by coming to work, right? And that's sort of the other side of the double standard. And I interviewed Ros Kelly, who was, like, a minister in the Hawke government, and she was the first woman to give birth as a federal MP, right?
Yeah.
She was the member for Canberra. And she used to do what she called the Kelly milk run, which is like she would like run home from the cabinet or whatever and feed the baby and then back in again. She lived in Canberra, so it was kind of like at least a bit more feasible. But she took something like 2 days off, if that, to give birth. She was nobody else had done it before. And so she didn't want to be accused of slacking off. Like she wanted to keep her job. She drove herself absolutely into the ground. She was loudly criticised for coming back to work and, like, this is child abuse and all this sort of stuff. It's, like, full on. But as a result, she kind of worked herself into an absolute, absolute frenzy. And I want to play you something which is, I don't know, it's so hectic that I love this little story from her. And it's about what happened after the birth of her second child because she went and had another one to follow up. Oh, my God, here she goes.
Ben was born on the 4th of November and I remember laying a wreath on the 11th, holding my stomach in while I was laying the wreath at the cenotaph. And, of course, also when Ben was, I think he was only 9 days old, we had the opening of the election campaign in Sydney. So I had to pick the baby up and off we go to the campaign. Then we did a whole campaign. So by then I'd been working flat out and it was Christmas Day. And, of course, I, my usual way, so I can manage all this. So I invited the Keatings around for Christmas lunch. And why I did this, I do not know. So anyway, I'm there, and Christmas morning, I get up to go to Mass. I just started vomiting. I could not stop. And what had happened, obviously, my body had just said, enough is enough. I pushed myself so much that when I stopped, I just couldn't stop being sick. So I still remember this scene of Paul and Anita coming over with their 3 kids, my 2 babies, and David trying to cook this turkey. Oh, it was ridiculous. And I could do nothing except vomit.
I just think every now and again when I'm having a busy day, I just think, at least I'm not trying to cook turkey for Paul Keating whilst chucking up everywhere.
Oh, that's just shocking.
But, like, they didn't have rules. Like, they didn't have a kind of way to be like those early women. There wasn't a childcare centre in the parliament. Like,
is there now?
Yeah, there is. But good. You know where the childcare centre is now?
Ages away.
It's where the old bar was. Like they've
really?
Yeah. And because Parliament House was built with a bar but not with a childcare facility. And it took years of campaigning, years of women in the Parliament campaigning. You know, because the childcare centre is not just for MPs.
Yeah.
Like it's for staffers and people who work in the building and journalists use it too. But, like, it's kind of obvious now that it's there, but at the time it wasn't. And so they found these amazing ways of coping. And even, like, you know how I told you,
sound like an amazing way to cope, to be honest, to throw up.
No, actually, you're quite right. It was a debacle. It was amazing. Those days were so wonderful, apart from the vomit. But, like, you know Susan Ryan, who I was telling you about before, she was the first, she was the, you know, only woman in the Hawke cabinet for years and years. And she was, you know, the one who introduced and got through Parliament the Sex Discrimination Act. She's an amazing, amazing woman. And look, very sadly, while we were making this series, I was talking to Susan and she died very suddenly and shockingly. And it was 4 days before we were supposed to be interviewing her for the series. But I did do a, for some reason I recorded one of the conversations that I had with her. And she has, I think, possibly the greatest kind of ad hoc babysitting arrangement story that I can remember anyone telling me. And that is in 1975, which is when Susan ran for the Senate. She was also from the ACT and she was the first woman to represent the ACT in the federal parliament. And that was 1975 was the year that the Whitlam dismissal happened, right? So, like, the Labor Party is in complete disarray because there's been this huge, like, constitutional crisis. Everything is going on. And Susan Ryan's like, well, I'm quite optimistic about Labor. I'm very excited about joining the parliament. And there's all these men just going, oh, we're screwed. Anyway, so she was the first woman and she was like, I'm a feminist, and they're like, don't talk about that too much on the campaign, love. But she also then had to campaign. 1975, she's got two little kids. She's a single mother. So,
is this one that you said had 11 kids?
No. That was a much earlier woman. This one has two, and she's a single mum, though, in the 70s.
Wow.
And she's trying to campaign. And so what happened at the time?
I can't believe I don't know more about her. Why aren't we talking about her?
We're talking about her now.
I know. Which
she
is
wasn't
good.
Ever a big noter, actually, Susan Ryan. So I like to talk about her a lot because she's kind of like an amazing woman. And anyway, 1975, there she is facing a campaign, and she's got these two little kids. And because of the sort of crisis, I'm told that Germaine Greer kind of was outraged by what had happened to the Whitlam government and said, what do you need me to do to help with the campaign, comrades? And they're like, would you mind looking after Susan Ryan's kids? So I am not joking. In the 1975 campaign, Susan Ryan's children were babysat by Germaine Greer, and here she is. Apologies for the sound quality because it's just like a phone conversation that I recorded. But this gives you an idea of how funny and awesome Susan Ryan is. Here she goes.
I love so much that Germaine Greer was your babysitter during that campaign. It makes me scream with laughter.
Yes, oh well, you know, networks.
Was she much of a babysitter though?
When I came back, I'd spent a day in Griffith trying to support Al Grassley and I came back on the Greyhound bus, you know, and got to my house and there was sort of warfare between Germaine and my daughter Justine because Germaine had been trying to teach Justine how to make a cake and there had been disagreement. I mean, I never tried to tell Justine how to make a cake. I'd let her make cakes, but Germaine thought this is something she'd do and it didn't work out. But anyway, apart from that,
well, certainly given Justine an excellent anecdote to be going on with in life.
Oh, that story. Oh, my gosh. I don't think Germaine was much of a baker either, but felt it was something that she really had to do with those poor children.
Which is odd. considering her
beliefs. I know. But anyway, there you go. It just goes to show the completely weird ways that women kind of adopted to get through this process without formal support, really.
It's fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. Wasn't there one thing that I remember was that big controversy about the breastfeeding and...
Yeah. Well, you know, you've only been allowed to breastfeed in Parliament House, you know, in the chamber for not very long. And in fact...
I'm not surprised by that somehow, though. That's still something that is so controversial for some reason. Right. Even breastfeeding in public and stuff, right?
Oh, yeah. No, there's definitely a weird sort of taboo element to it. But like in the Parliament, it was actually more of an issue of, in the Parliament, you're not supposed to step onto the floor of the Parliament unless you're an elected representative, right?
Oh. And the baby.
That's the rule.
Like, really? So that's...
And they call it stranger in the house, right? Like, and that's a no thing. You can't have a stranger in the house. You have to be elected or, you know, undertaking a formal role like a clerk or Hansard or whatever. And so Sarah Hanson-Young, when she was elected to the Senate for the Greens, had a little baby.
Yeah.
She was having to come in and out of the chamber to do votes and stuff like that when her daughter was quite little. And she had to run into the chamber to vote, and she brought her baby, who just peacefully sat on her lap, and she was asked to remove the child because there was a stranger in the house.
Oh,
and
my.
So they had to take the baby off her, and the baby's just crying and like it was completely a debacle. And that's sort of one of the things that triggered, I think, a change in that regulation. And other women, including Larissa Waters, who's also a Green Senator colleague, have now, you know, I think after that a recognition that that needed to change. And so that has changed. You can take your babies into the house. And to be honest, there is actually now a member of the House of Reps, a woman called Annika Wells, who has twins that she gave birth to in the last year. Oh, my God.
And they both hang out with her.
Yeah, and sometimes I've seen them both on the floor of the Parliament. So, you know, I know, right? So a lot of stuff has changed. A lot of stuff has changed. And since the Roz days, where she didn't have anyone to look to and she didn't have anyone to... So she worked herself into the ground because she didn't want to be thought a slacker, you know?
Yeah, that more than anything else infuriates me. It really does, because it's, you know, you know what it is? It's the entitlement. It's the lack of gratitude. It's the, you know, like if you boil it down, right, humanity, we need mums. Like, we need people having children. And so to treat them as less than human for doing that is disgusting. But then to also believe that the only reason that we exist is to have children. You know what I mean? Like, it's an absolutely lose-lose situation. And I don't know how you even begin to grapple with it, because it's so, again, it's so ingrained. It's insidious. It's that whole thing of, you know, it's the argument that comes with the fact that women have lower wages. Oh, well, you also take time out for children, you know, all of that sort of thing. And it's this issue that I think is really hard to get around as a woman. From any angle. And then it's elevated in politics and it just...
But it is changing. It is changing. So, like, you would never have seen a kid anywhere in Parliament House, like, you know, 30, 40 years ago. And now there's not only kids in there, but there's also, like, male partners who are there, like, who've taken time out from work or who are at home. And that is becoming a more normal thing too. And the more of that you see, the more available that option is for people who want to give that a go. And, like, that, to me, I think about Roz and throwing up with the turkey and whatever, and I think I wish that she at that time had been able to look down into the future and see the change that she was beginning to bring about, you know?
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
I know that now she sees these women having babies in Parliament thinking, and it is genuinely, like, thrilled that it is easier for them, I think, than it was for her. And that's what it's all about, right? Change, evolution, making things a tiny bit easier for the person who comes after you, whilst also saving your great stories about the time that Jermaine Greer babysat your children. Oh, my God.
here's my big thing. Somebody said, the future is ... to me.
Mm-hmm.
My answer was shades of grey. And to me, that's progress, right? let's move away from black and white. Because black and white is stifling.
Right.
Yeah.
Because you've got to be one or the other, and then you spend your life feeling, maybe, am I doing a good job of this, or do I belong over there?
Yeah. Yeah. And Shades of Grey lets us have twins in the...
Yeah, she's looking pretty grey in the face every time I see her. Oh, sucks to be you. Hey, thank you. It's been lovely to catch up with you again.
Oh, you too. You're just the best, Grabs. Oh. Thanks again.
Next time.
Annabelle?
Steph?
I don't know how you feel about plugging stuff.
Oh, I feel cautiously okay.
Well, just so that you don't have to direct people to go and look at your face on a screen, let me tell them. Go and watch the show because it's got Annabelle Crab in it. And she's a crab.
It's got heaps of great women in it. Misrepresented. Now that you mention it, you can watch it all on iView right now. All of it.
All of it.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.